falsifying their microbiology data. They have to test the environment. They have to test the air. They have to test the water. They're fabricating that data. So what is real and what is fake?
Is there a particular story that sticks in your mind that you cannot shake?
I mean, I would have to say Peter Baker's investigations into the plant Wockhardt, which I chronicle in my book.
Peter Baker, the FDA inspector.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, from the moment that he lands at an airport, is followed by company representatives, one of whom, there's a man who yanks open the door of his cab, takes a hard look at him, closes it again. The investigators go to the plant. Several of them fall ill because of tainted water. They learn later that even as they were at night in the hotel room talking about their inspections and their findings, the company had bugged the hotel room. That is the level of the...
And how much support did he get from the FDA?
Minimal. Absolutely minimal. In fact, they pulled him off of doing inspections. I mean, he's one of the most, he's sort of the Pablo Picasso of FDA investigations.
And he left just now, just this past March.
That's
under
right.
The Trump FDA.
Yeah.
I want to thank you for being with us. We're going to do part two and post online at democracynow.org. Investigative journalist Catherine Eban is the author of Bottle of Lies, the Inside Story of the Generic Drug Boom. It's just been published. Her previous book, Dangerous Doses, a True Story of Cops, Counterfeiters, and the Contamination of America's Drug Supply. That does it for our show. Happy birthday, Samin Farkanday. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Community Advisory Board will meet Tuesday, May 21st at 6 p.m.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Bodie Phelps Angelversary and Protest on Friday, May 24th at 11 a.m. at Gresham City Hall. Bodie Phelps was 22 years old when two Gresham police officers shot and killed him on May 24, 2016. The gathering remembers Bodie Phelps with speakers, flowers, candles, and protest against police murder. Again, that's Bodie Phelps' Angelversary and Protest on Friday, May 24th at 11 a.m. at Gresham City Hall, 1333 Northwest Eastman Parkway in Gresham. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, tomorrow is the Multnomah County special elections, and more than half of the Portland Public School Board is up for grabs.
The Youth Liberation Front, a student-run organization founded in Portland, has now gone national. They're calling for a walkout tomorrow around school shootings, educational quality, and more.
And the Center for Biological Diversity, along with other groups, has filed a lawsuit challenging the approval of the nation's first commercial-scale oil shale mine.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, May 20th, 2019. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. A Multnomah County special election has crucial impact on Portland public schools. The election is tomorrow, May 21st, but election officials say only 10% of eligible voters have actually voted at this time. Ballots are due Tuesday, May 21st at 8 p.m. That's tomorrow. Four of the seven seats in the Portland Public School Board are in contention this election. These are from Zones 1, 2, 3, and 7. Zone 1 is uncontested, and Andrew Scott, the chief operating officer for the regional metro government, is the only candidate running in an active campaign. Zone 2 is contested by Michelle DePass and Shanice Clark. DePass is Portland Housing Bureau policy coordinator and has raised more than $41,000 for her campaign. Clark is a Portland State University Administrator. Zone 3 is the only zone with an incumbent, Amy Costam. She is being contested by candidates Deb Mayer and Wes Soderbeck. And Zone 7 is being contested by Pastor Ayla Lowry and her opponent, Robert Schultz. The new board will potentially give voters the choice to extend the school district's tax levy that would add $94.7 million to the district's general fund. They'll also be potentially bringing up a bond to fund school modernization that could cost upwards of $1 billion.
City Commissioner Chloe Udaly has gained new support for her revised legislation that limits a landlord's ability to perform criminal background checks. Willamette Week reports that City Commissioner Nick Fish is adding his support, joining Joanne Hardesty's staff in giving the ordinance tentative support. Revisions include, but are not limited to, making clear a landlord's first-come, first-served options are not removed, and rent requirements do not exceed 80% of median income.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown signed a bill Thursday that directs the state police to study how to increase and improve criminal justice resources to solve crimes against indigenous women. Oregon is home to 9 federally recognized tribes or confederations, and we've now joined a growing movement in the U.S. to investigate more of those murders and disappearances of indigenous women. Native American women have gone missing on reservations or been killed at a higher rate than other people, but officials say statistics are hard to come by amid confusion by law enforcement over who has jurisdiction, which also results in lax pursuit of cases. South Dakota and Washington are among states that recently passed similar laws. Bills before Congress call for the Justice Department to review how law enforcement is responding.
Santiam Correctional Facility in Marion County held their third Out of the Darkness Walk, hosted by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, or AFSP, last Saturday. Washington and Oregon have higher rates of suicide than the national average. Inmates told K2 News that they organized the walk, not the prison staff, with a goal to debunk misconceptions around inmate mental health. The correctional facility raised $3,000 for the Suicide Prevention Foundation, and organizers say most of that money was raised by the individuals in custody. Ryan Price, the director for AFSP, said he hopes other states can follow their lead.
Another mass shooting last night, this one close to home in inner southeast Portland, where 5 people were injured. The shooting took place at an all-ages venue where an event was taking place near the east end of the Hawthorne Bridge. Police say the shooting took place after an argument between 2 individuals. In the past week, throughout the United States, 7 people were killed in mass shootings and 49 people were injured in a total of 10 separate incidents.
Oregon Democrats say the gun control bill they traded for school funding will likely be back next session. Senate Bill 978 was killed in the state legislature as a deal to persuade Senate Republicans to end their 4-day walkout, return to the Capitol, and allow a vote on Oregon's school funding bill last week. The gun control measure would have required safe gun storage, placed liability on gun owners if a gun stolen but not reported and used to injure a person or property, outlawed untraceable and undetectable firearms, granted local authorities the power to regulate firearm access in public buildings, and allowed retailers to set higher minimum purchasing age restrictions. On the other hand, another gun control bill likely to pass this session would fix an oversight from 2018 when lawmakers closed the so-called boyfriend loophole in gun possession by people convicted of domestic violence. It passed out of the House a month ago with bipartisan support and is headed toward the Senate floor after a unanimous vote Thursday in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Governor Kate Brown has said she plans to sign the bill.
Sabrina Fulton, Trayvon Martin's mother and former Housing Authority employee, announced on Saturday that she will be running for office for the Miami-Dade County Community Commission. Fulton will face off against Miami Gardens Mayor Oliver G. Gilbert III for that position, keeping gun violence prevention as her main priority. Trayvon Martin was gunned down by neighborhood watchman George Zimmerman after leaving a convenience store unarmed in Sanford, Florida, 7 years ago. Zimmerman was acquitted. Since then, Fulton has joined the ranks of mothers who have lost sons or daughters to gun violence, intent on making a change by taking public office. Other mothers include Lucy McBath, mother of Jordan Davis, and Leslie McSpadden, mother of Michael Brown. Current Miami-Dade Commissioner Willis Howard will step down in 2020 due to term limits.
The Youth Liberation Front, a student-run organization founded in Portland, has now gone national with chapters in Portland, Seattle, Clark County, the state of Tennessee, all around the Midwest, and the southern U.S. The Youth Liberation Front is calling students across the country to walk out of class and protest on May 21st. Organizers have a wide list of demands, including the disarmament of campus security, police accountability, progress to end school shootings with a focus on mental health and background checks, as well as free college, increased wages for teachers, and the abolition of the state's Common Core standardized tests. The YLF states that until these demands are met, they'll strike daily and engage in civil disobedience.
Let's just start off by, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Youth Liberation Front, how you got started, who's involved, just a little bit about it.
Yeah, so the Youth Liberation Front started as a really small organization, just a couple of people, me and some friends. Our goal is to organize students and empower them to use their voices to fight for change in our country.
Okay, awesome.
Basically like through the means of direct action, protests, rallies, community gatherings, things like that. We recently started expanding a lot. We're throughout the whole Pacific Northwest now. We have chapters in the Midwest, the East Coast, and even the South. So,
wow. So, was there an initial event or something that got you guys started, or was it just looking at everything that's been going on? And when was it founded?
So, I guess technically we were founded around the same time Trump was elected. It was under a different name. I think it was Oregonians Against Trump, something like that.
Okay.
And it really just started expanding from there.
Mm-hmm.
We've always stood against Trump, and then from that there comes a lot of other issues, because it's not just about Trump and these activist movements. There's so many things that we have to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot to keep track of, really. There's ICE, which is completely out of hand, mimicking the Gestapo in almost every way. We have the school shooting crisis, which is just going and going nonstop. And it almost happened at Park Rose, which is just terrible.
Yeah. No, it's definitely, there's so many things going on right now that it's hard to keep everything in line. So can you tell us a little bit about the intended push for reform? So just talk a little bit about, I know you wrote about the school system, gentrification, police departments, taxation, kind of the things that you'd like to see happen.
I'd like to see major reform in the school system, because as students, we've seen forever that it's a system that does not work for the majority of students.
Mm-hmm.
It really ignores the voices of students, telling us to, conform to what they say instead of learning the things that we would like to learn and are interested in, and things and then more serious things. I mean, not more serious things, but life-threatening things, like the school shooting crisis. The school system still doesn't really do anything about that. They silence the voices of student activists who walk out of school. They did throughout, most schools did throughout the whole walkouts last year.
Mm-hmm.
So really, we need complete reform in the school system to make it student-orientated instead of what the administrators think should be happening.
How has the Youth Liberation Front seen, and even in your personal experience, the way that student activists have been treated at schools? How has the school district and administration kind of come against them? And also, like, how does the Youth Liberation Front plan on supporting these student activists in the future?
School administrations come down on student activists in many ways. It can go from as simple as, like, detention to suspension or even expulsion in some cases. It's ridiculous how hard the school administration tries to silence voices of students who are really calling for simple things, just like the school shooting issues. Like, the school administration, I've seen personally, my school administration at Beaverton, they have called cops to tear down posters that were hung around the school, not even on the school campus, but around the school. I was banned from my campus once for putting up posters on it.
Really?
Just like very simple things. It's not like I was vandalizing the campus. I put up a poster with tape. And it's just really petty things that the school likes to come after students with, just to silence their voices just a little bit, anything they can do.
Yeah.
Like what the cops do.
Yeah. So then how does the Youth Liberation Front, like that organization that you are a part of, plan to help uplift these student activist voices and support them directly?
Action. Mass action.
Okay.
Our whole point is to connect students as a network. So, like, really any student in our area or anywhere really who has an interest and a passion for change and is an activist and wants to stand up, then you're already a part of us, meaning that, you know, we're gonna try to connect with you, and if you want to connect with us, then that's great. We're here to organize with everyone we can and anyone who wants to.
Okay.
Just action.
Okay. So in your email that you sent to us, you brought up a couple topics about propaganda and the status quo related to gun violence. Can you dive into that a little bit further? I know you talked about how you are trying to put up a poster and that was taken down. Could you go into that a little bit?
Yeah. So everything is based on the status quo. That's just how society works. That's how capitalism makes it work. So with these school shootings, the reason why the government hasn't done anything to really stop them, to actually do the things that people have been saying for decades, you know, basic regulation, background checks, trainings, things like that, the government's just been ignoring that, all because of money, because guns make a lot of money. It's just enforcing the status quo. It's the system of capitalism just ignoring the deaths of children or money, and it's a horrible thing, and that's another thing that we're here to stand against, because it happens in every aspect of life. You know, like, kids are dying because the government won't do anything about guns because of money. They're also dying and being put onto the street because people can't afford to pay rent and the government wants money, so they have to be kicked out on the street so other people who can pay money get in. It's just with everything.
So do you have any, like, final words or messages that you'd like to convey to our listeners? Sentiment?
Yeah. If you are a student anywhere in the United States, Pacific Northwest, the Portland area, come take a look at us. Liberation Front, we're organizing. We're getting off our feet. We're getting this movement started. We need everyone.
Okay. Brady, thanks so much for talking today. I really, guys, success tomorrow.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for our KABU News in-depth interview live in studio with Felicity Fenton. She is the author of the book User Not Found from Fortland's Future Tense Books. Tonight at 6, it is Labor Radio. At 6:30, it is Prison Pipeline. Karen James will be interviewing David Rogers, Executive Director of the ACLU of Oregon. They'll be talking about district attorney policies in Oregon. Then at 7, it is Hard Knock Radio. Your weather for tonight, showers, low about 42. We have a 90% chance that you're going to get wet this evening. Rainfall amounts up to a quarter of an inch are possible. Tomorrow, showers again are likely. Thunderstorms also possible in the afternoon. Lots of clouds and a high near 60. On this date in history, in 1983, the discovery that HIV virus that causes AIDS was published in the journal Science. And in 1989, the Chinese authorities declare martial law in the face of pro-democracy demonstrations, setting the scene for the Tiananmen Square massacre. Your quote of the day comes from loquacious and late comedian George Carlin, who said, "One can never know for sure what a deserted area looks like."
Missouri's Republican governor is expected to sign a new abortion ban this week. The Missouri law, passed on Friday, follows a recent wave of anti-abortion legislation in Republican states in an effort to challenge Roe v. Wade in the U.S. Supreme Court. The most restrictive ban was adopted by Alabama last week. Missouri's new law would ban abortion after 8 weeks in all cases, including rape and incest, with extremely limited exceptions. Recently, the ACLU and Planned Parenthood have filed a lawsuit in Ohio for a similar law banning abortion after 6 weeks. Thousands of people protested in Alabama yesterday, including hundreds of women who dressed up in outfits like the Handmaid's Tale TV series based on the Margaret Atwood science fiction novel, which portrays a dystopian country with women forced into unwanted pregnancies.
The death of a Dallas transgender woman was confirmed on Sunday morning. Malaysia Booker was found shot to death northeast of downtown Dallas around 7 a.m. Booker had been the victim of a brutal beating earlier this year that happened in broad daylight. The video was posted on social media and quickly went viral, leading to the arrest of the assailant, Edward Thomas. Mayor Vincent Weddington of the Dallas Police Department said Sunday there is no definite connection between the shooting and the April assault by Thomas. According to the Human Rights Campaign, most of the 128 transgender people who were killed between 2013 and 2018 were women of color. Gender identity is currently not covered under Texas's hate crime statute. Thomas was charged with aggravated assault in the April attack on Booker.
John Walker Lind, dubbed the American Taliban, is scheduled for early release from his 20-year sentence on Thursday. Lind is now 38 years old. A former Marin County resident, he'll be freed from a federal prison in Terre Haute, Indiana. Having been sentenced to 20 years imprisonment in 2002, Lind pleaded guilty to giving support, service, and supplies to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. He was arrested on a battlefield in Afghanistan in November 2001 following the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He had first arrived there in May of 2001. Under the terms of his sentence, Lind will be on probation for 3 years. Restrictions include Lind being unable to own an internet-capable device, inability to view or access extremist or terrorism videos, and probationary monitoring of any internet use. He's also prohibited from communicating with anyone online in any language other than English and leaving the U.S. without permission of the court. Lind will also be required to undergo mental health counseling. His family maintains he was a devout young man bent on helping the Taliban fight its Afghan enemies, not kill fellow Americans. Lind says he became interested in Islam after watching Spike Lee's 1992 biofilm on Malcolm X.
Time now for the Green News Report, 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and comment with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen of BradBlog.com.
It's Thursday, May 16, 2019.
CAL FIRE says that the campfire actually started in two separate locations, but that both ignitions were started by PG&E lines.
Utility company power lines caused deadliest fire in California history.
Exxon
ExxonMobil knew exactly that climate change was real and man-made as far back as 1970.
Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere hits disturbing milestone, just as Exxon predicted decades ago. Delaying action on climate change could cost investors more than $1 trillion. Plus,
plant-based alternatives to meat might be considered fake, but the growth of the industry is very real.
Burger King takes the impossible Whopper nationwide.
All of those impossibilities and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Bad news for vegetarians. America is running out of impossible burgers. I know, it seems unlikely.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I think we all knew this was going to happen, but we now have the official cause of the fire that burned down paradise last year.
Yes, that's true. The California Department of Forestry confirmed on Wednesday that the deadly and devastating campfire that obliterated the town of Paradise, California last November was caused by aging electrical transmission lines owned by Pacific Gas and Electric. The most destructive fire in state history, it killed 85 people and destroyed nearly 19,000 homes and buildings. PG&E has since filed for bankruptcy protection to deal with the flood of lawsuits from catastrophic fires caused by its equipment over the last 2 years. The utility's new CEO pledged to state lawmakers on Wednesday to implement new policies to reduce the risk of catastrophic fires in the future.
Isn't it time that California simply take over PG&E at this point after deadly failure after failure like this?
That is under consideration because PG&E may also potentially face criminal charges.
And this supports your argument that you've offered for many years that these power lines ought to be buried. That ought to be part of the Green New Deal.
Meanwhile, the insurance industry is beginning to grapple with the mounting costs of climate impacts. It's now the top concern of the insurance industry. In the annual survey of insurance companies released this week by the Society of Actuaries, insurers listed climate change as the biggest risk facing their industry, by far. Failure to act on climate change is a big risk for investors, too. A new global assessment from the United Nations Environment Finance Initiative brought together 20 global fund managers to measure the impact of climate change on 30,000 of the world's largest listed companies. The report that they released this week calculated that further delay in tackling climate change could cost companies about $1.2 trillion worldwide over just the next 15 years.
But we can't afford to do anything about climate change, right?
That's what Republicans say.
They do.
And this week, scientists at Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii announced that the planet's atmosphere has now reached 415 parts per million of carbon dioxide due to human activity. The last time CO2 levels were this high, humans didn't exist. But ExxonMobil nailed it. Internal company documents revealed in a blockbuster expose by Inside Climate News show that all the way back in 1982, Exxon's own scientists informed its executives that burning fossil fuels would increase atmospheric CO2 to around 415 parts per million by 2020. And they predicted it would raise global temperatures nearly a full degree Celsius, causing major disruptions to the planet's stable climate. They were right about both targets.
They knew when this was going to happen for the first time in human history, and they knew to cover it up with millions of dollars.
And that's exactly what freshman Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York said when she slammed ExxonMobil in a fiery speech at a rally this week at D.C.'s Howard University to promote the Green New Deal. Ocasio-Cortez slammed polluters and politicians who claim the cost of fighting the climate crisis is too much.
What is too much for me is the fact that ExxonMobil knew exactly that climate change was real and man-made as far back as 1970, and instead of being part of the solution, they paid millions of dollars to lobby and lie and confuse the American public about it, endangering generations to come. That is too much for me.
And finally, a bit of good news. Fast food giant Burger King says its recent market test of the meat-free Impossible Whopper in St. Louis was so successful, it will roll out the plant-based burger patty to all of its more than 7,000 stores nationwide. It's just the latest and largest fast food chain to offer consumers meat-free choices. Eating less meat is just one way individuals can reduce their impact on the planet.
Very cool. You know, Del Taco's Beyond Taco is also delicious.
Good.
Better than their meat taco. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
A group of activists in London are currently blockading the entrance to BP, formerly British Petroleum. They're demanding an end to all new oil and gas exploration. One of the activists issued a statement that we're at a critical point in history and that science indicates we're destroying our planet. But activists say companies including BP are still exploring for new oil, getting us deeper and deeper into crisis. The protesters arrived at 3 a.m. today and encased themselves in heavy containers before the oil company's annual general meeting on Tuesday. Greenpeace said it was carrying out the action because BP was behaving as if the climate emergency was not happening.
The Center for Biological Diversity and other groups have filed a lawsuit challenging the approval of the nation's first commercial-scale oil shale mine. The massive Enefit project in northeast Utah would drain billions of gallons of water from the Green River, generate enormous amounts of greenhouse gas pollution, and worsen local air quality. The lawsuit contends the company failed to analyze the potentially devastating impacts of this oil shale mine to Utah's air, water, climate, and species.
Billionaire tech investor and philanthropist Robert F. Smith announced during his commencement speech at Morehouse College that he and his family would be paying off the student debt for the entire 2019 graduating class. Smith, founder of Vista Equity Partners, told the crowd that newly minted alumni from Atlanta's historically black college would go forth into the world student debt-free. Morehouse College held its 135th commencement ceremony this Sunday. Smith attended in academic regalia to receive an honorary doctorate and proceeded to ignite the crowd as he said towards the end of his address, quote, "We're going to put a little fuel in your bus." As of 2018, full-time tuition at Morehouse has crept to over $25,000, with added expenses including room, board, and books totaling over $48,000. Nationally, student loan debt has more than doubled in the last decade. College debt cancellation has become a hot topic, with some states and institutions moving to make college tuition free. Heralded as the richest black man in America, Robert Smith has a history of philanthropic donations, including one to Morehouse earlier this year to aid in scholarships.
After the Trump administration blacklisted the Chinese technology giant Huawei on Friday, Google's parent company Alphabet announced they will not be allowing Huawei to use their Android operating systems on their phones. Google said this move was in compliance with the Trump administration's decision to blacklist Huawei in their current trade war. Not having access to Google services will hinder many apps and features that rely on Google Maps, like ride-hailing apps Uber and Lyft, as well as food delivery apps Postmates and Caviar. Many Huawei phones already use the Android system and Google Play Store for apps and will remain unaffected for the time being. This will hinder Huawei's ability to develop technology for 5G, as they rely on many American components for their phones and other potential 5G technology.
Upwards of 29 inmates and three guards have been killed in a riot in a high-security prison in Tajikistan. A group of ISIS militia members apparently shot several guards, then released fellow convicts. The ISIS gunmen killed five prisoners before taking hostages and starting a fire. Many of the inmates are political prisoners, with two of the confirmed dead being members of the banned opposition Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan. It's unclear who else is among the dead. This is the second deadly prison riot in Tajikistan in the last 6 months.
Well, don't freak out, but a radioactive coffin may be leaking in the Pacific. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water.
A radioactive coffin may be leaking in the Pacific. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The threat of flooding in the Midwest will be high throughout this coming week, as rains are predicted for areas where the ground is already saturated and river levels are still elevated.
The National Weather Service reports that the Mississippi River has been above flood stage for many weeks, setting records in some places like Cairo, Illinois, and farther south in Natchez, Mississippi.
But the spring flooding of 2019, already the most damaging in 25 years, is not like that of the past.
Now floods come faster and more furiously than their 20th century counterparts, according to E&E News. Experts say they're also longer, less predictable, and cause more damage.
This is true especially in the Mississippi River's upper basin, where wetlands, forests, and prairies have been replaced by subdivisions, office parks, and tilled farms.
In addition to global warming, another factor at play is a persistent weak El Nino weather phenomenon that, according to NOAA, could last through the summer, meaning warmer, wetter conditions in the U.S.
Experts say that while the connection between climate change and sea level rise has been studied, its effects on river flooding less so.
In August of 1945, a U.S. plane dropped an atomic bomb over Hiroshima, Japan, destroying 90% of its buildings and killing 80,000 people.
One question that had gone unanswered was what happened to all the material that made up the city.
A study just published in the journal Anthropocene shows that much of the fallout has been found along the beaches near Hiroshima.
Raw material that once made up the city, its buildings, steel, and concrete, was swept up in the nuclear blast and fused by the heat before cooling and falling down as tiny glassy spheres that packed into sands.
The particles found on the beach are about a millimeter in size and are aerodynamically shaped, containing glass, iron, steel, and rubber.
Lead author Mario Wanyer made the discovery of the tiny particles on the Japanese beaches when he was searching for marine life and noticed the remnants of the atomic explosion.
The scientists figure that each square kilometer of beach, down to about 10 centimeters, contains up to 3,000 tons of these particles.
In a separate development, the UN Secretary General raised concerns last week that a concrete dome built to contain waste from atomic bomb tests is leaking radioactive material into the Pacific Ocean.
UN head Antonio Guterres described the structure in the Marshall Islands as a kind of coffin built in the 1970s containing radioactive soil and ash from test explosions that were dumped into a crater and capped with a concrete dome about 18 inches thick.
Yahoo News reports that it was only supposed to be a temporary fix, and the bottom of the crater was not lined, raising fears that the waste is leaking.
There are also concerns that the dome could crack if hit by a cyclone. Guterres said that the Pacific's nuclear history and its health consequences still need to be addressed.
Plastic pollution in the oceans may have an effect on the air we breathe.
We've known about the effects of plastics on marine life like turtles and whales, but little has been known about its effects on bacteria at the bottom of the food chain.
A new laboratory study shows that exposure to chemicals leaching from plastics interferes with the growth and oxygen production of Prochlorococcus, the ocean's most abundant bacteria that uses photosynthesis and produces 10% of the oxygen we breathe.
The tiny organisms are critical to the marine food web and contribute to carbon cycling, according to Lisa Moore, one of the co-authors of the study published in Communications Biology.
The researchers note in a release from Macquarie University in Australia that plastic pollution is estimated to cause more than $13 billion in economic damage to marine ecosystems each year.
As summer heats up, many of us will take a dip in a pool after working in the yard or exercising.
But the Water Quality and Health Council is warning that jumping in without first showering affects the chemistry of a pool's water, making it less effective in fighting germs.
Dirt, sweat, and personal care products like deodorants or makeup react with chlorine, reducing its ability to keep the water safe.
The council released a survey last week showing that more than half of Americans say they use the pool as a substitute for showering, and almost the same percentage say they never shower before swimming.
4 in 10 people said that they had urinated in pools as adults, which also makes pool chemicals less effective.
The council notes that rinsing off for just 1 minute before going in the pool removes most of the dirt, sweat, and anything else from a person's body.
And finally, the Chicago River, like many in the U.S., has problems with trash floating in the water. It's unsightly and harmful to wildlife. The group Urban Rivers, which works to restore habitats, has tried picking up garbage manually, but trash appeared at random times and places, and sometimes they'd remove it, and 2 hours later, it was back.
They wanted a more efficient way to collect trash around the clock. After brainstorming with technologists, the idea of a robot was hatched.
But unlike a Roomba that might wander around your house, the robot had to know what was garbage and what was wildlife. As Digital Trends explains, defining trash would be the same as how Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart described obscenity. We know it when we see it.
So Urban Rivers decided they needed human eyeballs to help and created TrashBot, a remote-controlled trash-collecting robot driven by pilots who see the river from its point of view by way of a smartphone or laptop.
Anyone with an internet connection will be able to steer the robot for a 2-minute spin to collect trash and then transfer it to a receptacle on the riverbank.
TrashBot, which is about the size of a kickboard, is due to go live at the end of this month when you can visit the Urban Rivers website to log on and take the helm.
This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Waterworks Association. Explore new trends in technology at ACE 19, June 9th through 12th in Denver. Learn more at awwaace.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 20th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jeffrey Wade, Christopher Jones, Kathy Seitz, and Kenzie Beard. The producer is Jim Thompson, and our engineer is Danielle Parks. The Interim Director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. In Depth is next.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Our News In Depth guest today is Felicity Fenton, author of the book User Not Found from Portland's Future Tense Books. User Not Found is a long-form essay about Felicity's attempt to withdraw from the internet, especially social media platforms such as Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, which she refers to as walls in the book. But it's more than a screed against internet addiction and our inability to put down our phones. It's an examination of identity, what we gain and what we lose when we engage in social media, and who we are and what we become when we disengage. We're fortunate to have Felicity in the studio with us now to talk about User Not Found and what she found when she disengaged. Felicity, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
Felicity, first a little background on you. Doing the research, I was amazed at the variety of work you do and the quality of drawing, painting, photography, conceptual art, of course, writing. And you have a show on our sister community radio station, Freeform Portland. How'd you ever find time for social media?
Oh, that's a good question. In the beginning, I used it as an art form, almost. I was sort of late in the game to social media, I guess, in the trajectory of it. I wasn't a part of Friendster I was very, in a limited way, a part of MySpace, but I think I had.
Well, that goes back.
It goes way back. Yeah, it goes way back. But then somebody invited me to Facebook, and it was all over. I thought, oh, no, what is this? And so I used it as a platform to for writing, for and strange status updates and performances.
And maybe promoting your work. A lot of artists do that.
Yeah, there was an element of that. Not so much in the beginning, though. It became more promotional, self-promotional, probably over the last 4 years.
Now, early in the book, you write, quote, "A digital applause makes art seem less lonely." As an artist, what were you getting online that you weren't getting in real life?
I think instant gratification is a big one, and it's something that I think we all can relate to and have probably grown to really appreciate. I think there's also an element of engagement on social media where people feel more comfortable saying things, comments in the comments section, or maybe not saying anything at all, but just, you know, hitting that thumbs up or heart is a way to support as one can.
And sometimes they feel a little too comfortable saying things.
Oh, yes.
social media.
Totally. I don't think I've never been trolled, thankfully.
Now, given the positives of social media, the digital applause, the sense of community, among other artists we just mentioned, you start the book with a negative experience, with a story of being unfriended, or as you put it, discovering that someone had erased me from their social walls. Did you take this as a rejection of your art, maybe of you personally?
I did. I have a big fear, and it's probably one of my biggest, you know, it's just like a fault of mine of disappointing others. And so I immediately took it to heart, and I thought, oh, what did I do? What did I possibly say online to upset this person? But I also sort of knew this person offline as well. I met this person online, but then I knew this person in the flesh. So it was a really strange situation where I didn't even know where to begin. And I reached out and never heard from them. And so it's still a mystery to this day. I don't know. I think it's, you know, people just need to pare down their life. I don't actually take it personally anymore. I think you get to a point where you're so inundated with people online and even offline, and the obligations run really high, and so I understand where people might need to just cut ties.
Was this experience then, Felicity, partly at least, something that led to your experiment to disengage from social media, and
yes,
and consequently, of course, resulted in the book?
Yeah. So there were a few other reasons. That was one of them, but it was probably not the primary reason. The primary reason was just on my travels over the last few years, I noticed how many humans were on their phones using the same interfaces, having the same sort of body experience. So lots of schlumping over the screens and scrolling. And it just seemed to me that the world was becoming one of just a monoculture. And so that was a bit scary to me. All the privacy stuff is a bit intrusive and frightening in terms of what they're doing with our data. And then witnessing my daughter and her just considering what it was that she was seeing me, her parent, and others who were older than her do.
You mentioned a remark about her parents. Early in the book about your face is always illuminated by the light from your screens.
Yeah, we were in Mexico City, and vacations are a really great opportunity to take a lot of photographs. And I was at the point where I was taking a lot of photographs and I was posting them on the walls. And it was a habit of getting up in the morning and checking. And she stated, "It's really strange for me to see my parents' faces always painted in light." And so that was the day I cut ties for a few months and started to log my response to that.
And we mentioned in the intro that you refer, and you just did, in fact, to the internet platforms such as Facebook, Twitter, Instagram as walls. My understanding, besides the obvious Facebook reference, writing on someone's wall, is that just as physical walls, the internet provides a certain amount of separation and protection in our social relationships, but also cuts us off from deeper engagement. But the cool part about doing these interviews is I get to ask you, the author, why'd you choose that term, walls?
Well, I mean, it is just that. It's a barrier, and it's something that you can't really break through it. We really rely very heavily on physical engagement as humans, as critters do the same thing. Eye contact, being in the same room and smelling somebody is so much, it's really important to communication and being a society, as a community.
And of course, you can't smell anybody on the internet.
No, I haven't succeeded in smelling anybody on the internet.
That's coming, I'm sure.
I don't know. I think I've heard this before. I've had conversations around smells and whether or not they can come out of the internet. But I don't know. Didn't they have smell-o-vision at one point?
Yeah, I guess it never took off. Yeah, and then of course, there's scratch and sniff, ads with the kind of reeking of cologne in your favorite magazine.
Yeah, so. Or McDonald's, like, scratch this. It smells like our french fries, and you'll just
it doesn't make me long for those french fries. But now, when you decided to disengage from the walls, you went cold turkey, right? Was your initial idea then to go for a certain amount of time?
I didn't have a timeline. I've done a lot of durational things in the past, and I gave myself a timeline. I spent a month one April writing down every single URL I visited that day. And it was time consuming.
Oh, actually writing down handwritten.
The URL. Uh-huh. And it was just to see where I was going. So I've had this relationship to the internet for quite a while. Some of my former work was about the internet. And but this situation was more of, ooh, I think I have a problem. So I'm going to just let it go for a while and write about it.
That was the entire internet, so it wasn't just the social media platforms. It was you didn't Google anything, or
no. So this and user not found. It was mostly just the walls. Mm-hmm. Just the walls, meaning Facebook.
Oh,
and
okay,
Instagram.
Those platforms.
And I wasn't ever good at Twitter. I'm still not good at Twitter. but the former project was called Internal Server Error, and it was a show. It was an installation at the former gallery called Place, that was in Pioneer Place Mall on the top floor.
Oh,
so that was a different experiment in disengaging or observing my own actions on the internet.
No. Let's talk a little about the disengagement. You find a positive in something most of us try to avoid: boredom. And you write early in the book, oh, how nice it is to feel you again. You're talking about boredom, or addressing boredom. You come in gusts late afternoon, mid-mornings at stoplights, standing in lines. How daunting it was to feel you at first, your excruciating nothingness. How did you grow to enjoy boredom? Something, again, most of us do try to avoid.
Yeah, I guess my peak addiction on the walls was probably the last, I'd say 3 years before this book. I was spending time in lines, waiting in line, and I would just be scrolling. wherever I was in traffic, I'd be scrolling, and just on the corner, I'd be scrolling. I'd be standing in my kitchen scrolling, and I think I realized, oh, I don't feel the need to scroll, and I can just look around and see what other people are doing. I can take in the lights. I can take in the sunset. I can smell the flowers. All that stuff is so mundane. I mean, not the flower part. Flowers are far from mundane.
I have a quote for you then, because we talked a little earlier before we went on the air that you have a radio show on Freeform Portland. It's called Bachelard's Panty Drawer, mm-hmm. after the French philosopher Gaston Bachelard. Mm-hmm. So I dug up a quote from him, and he said, "Reverie is not a mind vacuum. It's rather the gift of an hour which knows the plenitude of the soul."
Ah, that's beautiful.
I think you pretty much just said the same thing, though, in terms of
different vocabulary.
Not scrolling. Of course, he probably said it in French, too. So. but not scrolling and then noticing all these things around you. In other words, it was a very positive and constructive reverie. I almost wonder, do you think that's a necessary part of art, of creating art, is to feel that kind of boredom, where you're not engaged with a screen 24 hours a day or the majority of a day?
I don't know if it's just art. I think it's just, it's about presence and really absorbing your space. So not only your body, but your environment, being present with the people you're sitting across the room from. So I think it's something that, yeah, it's important as an artist for sure, because I think it's important in general to just is pay as much attention as you can, because you learn a lot when you pay attention.
And you had another part in the book I'd like to read just this. It's actually an excerpt from the section, but you talked about the pre-internet world, so where reveries were more common, apparently. And I quote from the book, "We walked through Brooklyn in bare feet. We drank bodega beer and bantered about new bands and rancorous poets. We sipped coffee while scribbling notes on paper. We wrote letters on word processors. We exchanged mixed cassette tapes. We listened to records from start to finish. I wonder, what have we lost, or more to the point, what has the internet taken from us?"
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's subjective, too, because I think some people feel really fulfilled by the internet and have a different experience than I do. But I know that I've had to relearn how to do a lot of those things that you just listed in that passage. And I happen to really enjoy tactile things. I enjoy the drop of a needle onto a record, that crackle. I really like hearing what a musician does from start to finish, and maybe what their intent was in an album. I don't know if musicians even have that intent anymore. There's also been conversations about that I've had.
No, because people consume music a song at a time. It's Spotify or Pandora, where there used to be concept albums. You listen from start to finish. I'm dating myself, but there were LPs where you had to actually go and turn over the record, but you had a complete experience. And it seems that that's somewhat been taken away from us. People don't really have that attention span, maybe because of social media and the internet.
For sure. I noticed, I still have my phone in my bag a large part of the time, but the thing that I am mostly drawn towards is checking my email and checking text messages. And so that's something I'm working on. But I noticed when I went cold turkey with the walls, from the walls, I definitely felt my attention span coming back. It was, I could read sentences without rereading very complex passages from essays. I didn't have to furrow my brow so much, or, you know, it just wasn't as fatigued. I didn't get as fatigued. So it's probably a combination of my eyes not being as tired from all the screens.
Did that affect your art as well, in addition to your attention span?
Well, I don't know. I'd say that maybe there's more focus. I think so. Maybe there's more focus.
Now, of course, from what you just said, you're back on the internet, but somewhat more limited. You even posted about this interview on Facebook this morning where I saw it. After the writing of User Not Found, do you find yourself using it more selectively?
Very selectively. And I feel really conflicted about my use, because it's... There's the self-congratulatory aspect of it that I'm wary of. I just had something published in the Iowa Review, and they really persuaded me with a sheet of paper that came with the book to post this and to share. And I realize that there are certain presses and certain small, you know, nonprofits that would benefit from the people who they've taken on to post about whatever it is they're doing with them. So I feel a little bit of responsibility to do that. But at the same time, I'm wrestling with it, because I don't really want to be there. And I think the reasoning behind me being there is still probably tethering on ego.
Well, I know other artists and writers who feel the same way, but it's very difficult to promote your work now without social media, unfortunately.
Yeah.
My favorite writer of all time is a Thomas Pynchon, who's known for kind of disappearing from public view. Of course, he started about 50 years ago. He's able to get away with it, but I don't think any writer can do that now.
There are a few. So Mary Ruffel, she's a pretty well-known Luddite. Otessa Moshfe, she doesn't use the walls.
I guess I should mention also I've interviewed him several times. So William Volman.
Okay.
Purposely, he doesn't own even credit cards. He's totally off the grid.
Good for him. Yeah. If you can do it. And I think once you reach a certain caliber, people can do it for you. And you don't even potentially know. You just know that, oh, I'm getting paid sometimes.
Well, Felicity Fenton, User Not Found is so beautifully written, filled with great lines, and I would say great wisdom. Thanks so much for coming into KBOO.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
We've been talking with Felicity Fenton, author of the book User Not Found, from Portland's Future Tense Books. For more information on Felicity and her work, you can go to her website, felicityfenton.com, and for information on how to purchase User Not Found, print or even ebook, you can go to futuretensebooks.com. And to paraphrase Felicity, when you're done listening to this newscast, go outside. Good things happen outside. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
Thank you for that. That was wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next at 6, it's Labor Radio. Then at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. And at 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knocks Radio.
In the criminal justice system, and Oregon law provides district attorneys with enormous discretion to make decisions about who and how people are prosecuted. Yet, a recent study found that many district attorneys lack basic policies to guide their core duties as prosecutors in Oregon. Join us May 20th on Prison Pipeline as ACLU of Oregon reveals their findings and promotes House Bill 2.